Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the winner of the Tulsa Library Trust Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award for 2013. Kazuo Ishiguro is a Japanese-born British writer whose works have been universally acclaimed. His novels have received four Booker Prize nominations, and he won in 1989 for his best-known work, The Remains of the Day. The Remains of the Day, like most of Ishiguro's work, features the first-person narrative, in this case of an English butler named Stevens, as he reflects on his life and devotion to service over the years, and how he eventually comes to the realization that devotion has meant he has missed much of what is important in life. The Remains of the Day also became a very successful motion picture with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. Ishiguro's other works include his most recent novel, Never Let Me Go, The Unconsoled, An Artist in the Floating World, and When We Were Orphans. His most recent work include a collection of short stories, Nocturnes, Five Stories of Music, and Nightfall. And he also has been writing lyrics for jazz singer Stacey Kent for her 2009 release, Breakfast on the Morning Tram. He'll be giving a free presentation to the public Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library to speak, take questions, and sign books. Kazuo Ishiguro is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Kazuo Ishiguro, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the Helmrich Prize.
Thank you very much indeed. It's very nice to be with you.
As you know, I read through a couple of the books and read through some of the other of your output over the years. I'm really struck by the sense of memory. Of course, Mr. Stevens in Remains of the Day, but in other books too, the central theme is characters summing up their lives. What is interesting to you about that process?
Well, when I was a younger man, you know, when I first started to write books, I think I used to worry about this. I used to think, I'll get to a certain age, and I'll look back over my life, and all the things I'm proud of will look bad. You know, that might have something to do with the fact that I was born in 1954 in Japan. That's to say, you know, the generation just before me, that was the generation that got caught up in all the militaristic, you might even call fascist fervor, you know, in Japan, that led up to the Second World War. And I guess it's quite natural for people born in Japan of my generation, also Germans, I guess, to ask themselves, you know, what would I have done had I been part of that kind of social fervor? And so I started to actually look at the life I was leading in the 1970s, 1980s, and I was always asking myself, would I regret this? I mean, am I investing in the right kinds of things? I don't mean financially. I mean morally, in terms of my efforts, in terms of my work. I was very aware that perfectly decent people who wanted to do good things in the world had actually found themselves on the side of evil, if you like, you know, just because of the times they had lived through and because of the history that they had lived through, and simply because they weren't extraordinary and they didn't have the perspective on the times that they lived in. And in my particular case, yes, I was very conscious of the people in Japan and I suppose Germany leading up to the and during the Second World War. But it can be applied, you know, I guess we should all be watchful about any era that we live through. We may be very proud of what we're doing. We may think we're achieving a lot of things, but often history has a way of, you know, shining a light on what we're doing, and it suddenly looks awful. You know, values can take a complete change beneath our very feet. And so particularly some of those earlier books, including The Remains of the Day, I mean, I was always very preoccupied with that kind of situation. Somebody approaching old age, you know, looking back over a life they thought they could be proud of, but history has shown that they should perhaps be ashamed of it, and the difficulties that raises, you know, emotionally. And this is where memory comes into it, as you say. Memory becomes an enemy, but also sometimes you know, a very tough friend that could maybe lead to your kind of redemption. You know, you don't want to remember a lot of the stuff, but there's a part of you that says, you know, have a look at it.
And memory can also be a friend somewhat in sort of rearranging the events to put yourself in a better light, too, oftentimes.
Memory can be a very kind of a false friend, yes. I guess, in that sense. Mm-hmm. Because memory can aid self-deception, all these things. And to some extent, you know, I think most of us need a healthy bit of self-deception to just get through. I mean, most of us don't lead exemplary lives, you know. I'm not saying that we should, you know, which is scrutinize our kind of moral performance, you know, that rigorously. But yes, I mean, memory, I mean, we have a way of selecting things, kind of rearranging things so that things look palatable to us, so that we want to look like we're coming out better than perhaps we really should do. But I also think there's a part of us that wants clarity and honesty. There's a small part of us somewhere deep in, within us that usually says, well, but what, you know, what really happened? Do I really deserve to be proud of that? Did I really behave as I should have done? Whatever you say in public, I think there's a part of us that demands that honesty as well. So I think in a lot of my books, that's what's happening. People are going through their memories, playing a kind of hide-and-seek with their own past. You know?
Now, you were earlier saying this as a part of the generation that was born after World War II in Japan, but you left Japan at 5 or 6 years of age?
That's right. I was 5 years old, yeah.
How much of that do you think sort of seeped into you in those 5 years, that feeling you said that's so common in the Japanese people of that generation?
I don't think it seeped into me in any direct sense. You know, when I was 5 years old, I knew very little about the war or anything like that. I mean, I was conscious that there had been this war. And I was born in Nagasaki, so I was actually very conscious that there was an atomic bomb, you know. But I didn't really know what it meant. But in a funny sort of way, because I grew up in the West, I grew up getting the version of the Second World War that said the Japanese and the Germans were the baddies. You know, they were the bad guys. They did terrible things. And so in some ways, perhaps, I was less, you know, I was less prone to any kind of societal self-deception. In some ways, if I had just grown up in Japan, I may never have had that kind of perspective on the war. Because, I mean, I'm not sure if Japanese people think about it very much. You know, they weren't made to go through that kind of soul-searching process that the Germans were made to go through. And the atomic bombings, I think, to some extent, gave them a victim identity, mm-hmm. Rather than the perpetrators of great atrocities in Southeast Asia and China. But I'd also say that, you know, when I grew up here in Britain, I was also part of a younger generation that was quite politicized, say, compared to the young generation today. We were the generation of student protests, and I came a little bit after the first wave of kind of student radicalism, but I was involved in various kinds of social work projects and things like this, and most people were obliged to take some sort of political position on many issues. And I think it was because I was surrounded by people who outwardly, anyway, had to express pretty certain views and commit themselves pretty dogmatically to, you know, certain ways of doing things over things like nuclear disarmament or whatever, that I started to think, well, is this just another version of this kind of political fervor that overtook the generation before me? You know, it may not be on that same scale. It may not lead to a world war. But nevertheless, you know, I was living in a time when people still worried about a nuclear holocaust, you know, a shootout between the Soviet Union and the West. And the stakes could be very, very high. So I started to ask myself these very questions because I think we were part of a kind of a politicized generation. We had kind of badges on our T-shirts, and we kind of chanted and marched in demonstrations. And that does make you wonder sometimes, you know, have we got the perspective? I mean, are we making the same mistakes? And so I think that became a preoccupation of mine as I was becoming an adult and, you know, went into my adulthood. You know, to what extent do you have to actually make a commitment and make a stand, you know, make a decision? To what extent do you have to always step back and say, look, you know, we're not going to just go along with the kind of fervor of our peers. And you have to take a step back because throughout history people have done this and made mistakes.
And in the first three books, A Pale View of the Hills, An Artist in the Floating World, and The Remains of the Day, each one of these narrators are explaining how they did or didn't make those decisions.
Exactly. That's what those first three books are about. You know, the first two are often in the context of Japan and the before and after the war. The third book, The Remains of the Day, is about England and Europe, you know, before and after the Second World War.
Was that a process of your growing as a writer or growing confidence as your writer to move from Japan to England and to now where you write about any place?
I guess confidence, you could call it confidence. I mean, to me, it felt more like it came out of a certain frustration. You know, when I was writing my Japanese books, I was getting kind of very good reviews, but I felt I had a kind of a limited audience, only people who were interested in kind of Japanese matters or Japanese society were going to come and look at my books. And artistically, I felt, you know, I have the arrogance of a writer. You know, I thought I was trying to address kind of universal human themes, you know, but people will say, oh, he's writing very interestingly about the Japanese mind, or, you know, he's done a lot of research about what it felt like to be Japanese at that time, you know. But I wanted to say, no, right, it just happens to be in Japan, but I think these are things that will keep happening, and, you know, I'm talking about being human, you know. And I kind of thought the Japanese setting kind of made people read the books in a very limited and literal way. And I thought, well, if I did make a conscious decision for my third book. You know, I'm going to write a book that has nothing to do with Japan or Japanese people. Let's see if people read me more broadly. You know, let's see if they see that various kinds of universal metaphors come out of whatever story and setting I put this in. And by and large, I think I was proven to be right. You know, people read The Remains of the Day as a much kind of bigger book, simply because it wasn't just about Japan. You know, some people said it's about English butlers or something, but most people kind of understood that it, you know, there was a kind of a metaphorical dimension to that, and you could apply that story to a much more universal kind of context.
I thought it was an incredible, interesting decision to set it among a man whose mission in life is to give service. How did the idea of setting this story with a butler, if those themes were exploring a life, exploring whether, you know, why you didn't stand up to something that was not right, why you denied yourself in the case of Mr. Stevens, you know, the essential elements of humanness in this ideal version of service and dignity.
I tell you what, in the books I wrote earlier, you could almost look at the two earlier books as kind of like how-to books, you know, about how to waste your life. You know, if you wanted to waste your life, you know, do what these guys did. But they were very much how to waste your life in the context of career, vocation, and, you know, the moral impact of your work.
Right.
It seemed to me by the time I'd finished my second book that there were other very profound ways in which a human being could waste their lives, namely in the personal arena. And so I wanted to write about a man who wasted his life not simply because he invested in the wrong values, but also because he failed to love and be loved. He wouldn't allow himself to be loved, and he wouldn't allow himself to love because of some kind of strain, perhaps because of a fear of the realm of emotions, perhaps because of a misguided idea about professionalism. And so The Remains of the Day, for me, was to some extent a retread of what I had written about before, about, you know, a well-intentioned man realizing in old age that he'd got it wrong. But it wasn't just in terms of career. It was in terms of personal life. Mm-hmm. And so it's just as much a book about somebody who fails in love at every level, you know, not just romantically, but with his fellow human beings. And so it seemed to me a butler was the perfect metaphorical kind of figure, if you like, or perfect kind of figure, because the stereotype of the butler acts in both arenas. The servant who thinks big politics, big moral decisions is something he should leave to his betters. You know, that was a very important dimension for me of the butler figure. The other thing about the butler figure that I wanted was, you know, that the butler, particularly the English butler, has a reputation for being emotionally completely frigid. You know, that's partly what the persona is. In order to make himself acceptable, you know, as someone who moves around the people he serves without them having to really respond to him as a human being, so, you know, he has to make himself a kind of a robot, so that you know, he's there and not there. You know, he's physically there, and he's got to kind of erase his personality. That was the ideal of the kind of servant, and to some extent, even today, the waiter in a restaurant tries to kind of aspire to that kind of thing. And so it seemed to me that the butler embodied both of those things I wanted to talk about, the political and moral servitude, if you like, on the one hand, and the emotional, kind of the frozen emotional persona on the other. You know, I thought, well, the butler, I'll get it in one, if, you know, I get two for the price of one. And so I created this butler, you know, and I was able to talk about both of those things.
My guest today is Kazuo Ishiguro, winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmerich Distinguished Author Award given by the Tulsa Library Trust. He's the author of The Remains of the Day, An Artist in the Floating World, When We Were Orphans, Never Let Me Go, and his most recent work has been a collection of stories, Nocturnes, Five Stories of Music and Nightfall, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to talk a little bit about yourself. I know that you were talking about reflecting on the early part of your life and how your work reflects on life, but you've had some really interesting experiences from, I think you visited America about the time you came of age and did everything from hop a freight to hitchhiking across America. You had a stint as a summer in Scotland as a grouse beater for the Queen Mother. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes, yes. That, the first kind of job I had, it was only for a month, you know, between school and university. I did actually work for the Queen Mother, the mother of the present Queen. They're both called Queen Elizabeth, but this was the mother of... This is a character who was played by Helena Bonham Carter in The King's Speech, you know, that lady. At that point, she was in her 70s, a very, you know, a very nice, charming, and quite eccentric, you know, Queen Mother, and I was very fortunate enough to be one of her beaters, you know, which meant that I, you know, I would help her and her guests shoot a lot of birds in Scotland, and occasionally pick up sort of blood-stained birds and present them to her or to her gillies. But that was, you know, the America thing was very formative for me because I was 19 years old, and I spent 3 months traveling in the United States in 1974, a very interesting period in, I now think, you know, looking back.
Oh, yeah, our country was in turmoil. I mean, utter turmoil.
I didn't realize it then. I mean, it seemed like it was very orderly in a way, but looking back now, I think it was quite divided. You know, I traveled through California, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, and, you know, I was thrilled by America then. I went to America because... You know, I was a big kind of American music fan, and like a lot of people at that time, a lot of the exciting things seemed to be coming from America. But it was an America that was very, particularly amongst the young people I met, it was divided, severely divided by the Vietnam War, particularly that, you know. I was meeting people of my age who'd been over to America, who were about to, over to Vietnam, who were about to go to Vietnam. I met people who were dodging the draft. You know, it seemed very, very big. It was the time of Richard Nixon. He was still in power then. And but there were many, many... You know, I had a wonderful time. I mean, America was for me, it was a wonderful place at that point. And the freight train, well, I don't know who told you, I hopped a freight train. I got on one when it was still and stationary in a freight yard. I think to actually hop a freight train is an incredibly dangerous thing because... even just climbing on a still one was difficult enough. I don't know how people can jump on one without going underneath and dying. You know, in general, it's not something I would recommend to anybody. You know, particularly to young people. I think it's very, very dangerous for many kinds of reasons.
Now, getting back to your writings after The Remains of the Day, your next book was The Unconsoled. After all the success you've been nominated for the Booker Prize. And winning prizes, and of course you won with The Remains of the Day. Was The Unconsoled sort of an attempt to break with what you'd done before?
I suppose every book I write, in some way, you know, I'm trying to break with what I did before. You know, Remains of the Day, I tried to break with the whole kind of Japanese novel thing. And when I wrote The Unconsoled, I mean, it was the only book I could write at the time. Yeah, it's not as though I have a wealth of options in front of me every time I write a book, and I think I'll do this project. You know, I'm not a particularly inspired person. I don't have a wealth of ideas, and usually for emotional and kind of reasons of the number of ideas I have in my head, there is usually only one book I can write. At the time of in writing The Unconsoled, you know, that was the book I very, very much wanted to write, and it meant taking a big step away from what you might call the mainstream realist novel. And so I think that The Unconsoled probably didn't console many people. I mean, it disconcerted a lot of people. It surprised a lot of people because it doesn't work in the kind of a traditional way. And perhaps there was even more of a kind of a mismatch to some extent between the book and the readership, because the movie of The Remains of the Day had come out just before I published that book. It was a very successful Hollywood movie, a very beautiful film, you know, with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson and so on. And I think there was an audience had built up, because, partly because of The Remains of the Day, the book, but also immediately before The Unconsoled because of that movie. And a lot of those people came to this strange dream kind of novel.
Thinking they're going to have another Ivory Merchant experience.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected James Ivory to make a movie of that, but he's always expressed very kind views about that book. But nevertheless, The Unconsoled it sold fewer copies than all of my other books, you know. But wherever I do an event, a speaking event of any sort, there's always somebody who puts their hand up during the questions and wants me to talk about that book. It happened last week when I was talking at a university. It doesn't seem to want to go away. And I was, last time I was touring the United States, would never let me go. I was told that there was a bunch of people around Berkeley who were very keen on this book and wanted to talk about it. So it's an odd kind of cultish kind of following, I think. It even looks to me like a strange book now, but it's a book that followed a kind of a dream logic,
right?
And it behaves a bit like a frustration dream, or an anxiety dream. You know these dreams where you can never quite get to the room that you need to get to, and there's always some very pressing task that you have to do, and you can't remember what it is, and you're always very worried about something. You're not quite sure what it is you're worried about. I mean, it's all like that. Very different from The Remains of the Day, or indeed from Never Let Me Go. You know, but it's a kind of a writing that I always feel I need to go back to at some point.
Well, you know, it's somewhat joicing in a way, because you know, people refer to it either as, you know, that the critical response is indecipherable, and the other side is masterpiece.
Yeah, well, indecipherable is a kind of a polite way to put it. There are far ruder words than that. And then there were people who originally wrote very kind of derogatory things about it, who about 2 or 3 years later went into print reversing their original opinions. You know, it's a strange kind of it provoked a strange response, and I suppose it was around that point that I started to feel the freedom to be able to write, you know, maybe difficult novels, but the kind of novels that I thought would be interesting to write. I kind of almost felt at that point, you know, I was still a young guy. I was in my mid-30s when I started that book. Not many people have the luck that I had had. You know, you win a kind of a international audience and prizes, and, you know, you sell a lot of copies. You have a big movie made of your last book. I thought, well, look, if I'm in a very privileged and fortunate position here. You know, I shouldn't just play safe. You know, I have almost kind of like a duty. If I feel like trying to do something daring or trying to take the novel somewhere, I've got a very good chance, you know, that a larger audience would come with me than if some kind of obscure but brilliant writer is doing it in a garret somewhere, you know. So I thought, who else is going to do it if I'm not going to do it? So as I say, I didn't have much hesitation. That was the book I wanted to write, and I wrote it year after year. You know, it was a strange experience.
My guest today is Kazuo Ishiguro, winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmreich Distinguished Author Award. Before I let you go, I want to ask about another side of your writing that most people might be unaware of. You like to write lyrics and have done some lyrics, collaborated with Jim Tomlinson and Stacey Kent.
That's right. Actually, that's how I started out as a writer of fiction. I started by writing songs. Between the age of 15 to when I was about 22, I think I wrote over 100 songs. Now, I was writing the music myself in those days, which was kind of the problem, I suppose. But but you know, I've always been a keen amateur musician, and in those days, my dream was to be like a singer-songwriter of that time, the 1970s singer-songwriter. You know, but I feel now, looking back, that I served my apprenticeship as a writer of fiction, writing those songs. That's where I really learned a tremendous amount of craft. And the voice I had as a writer, when as a fiction writer, you know, when I wrote my first novel, is more or less the voice I ended up with as a songwriter. I'd worked through all those stages that I see many young writers going through, writing their first, second novels. I went through them writing my songs. You know, I wrote these intensely autobiographical kind of things, you know, in my songs. And I went through my kind of wild, although we're talking about the Uncle, so I did go through a wild kind of Joycean kind of purple prose kind of phase, but in my songs, you know. And by the time I finished writing songs, my style was very pared down, and I'd figured out that, for me anyway, it worked to have the meaning fall between the lines, you know, because in a song you have very, very few lines. And the song is, of course, for a voice. And, you know, I moved quite easily into this kind of first-person-based fiction, very much centered around the voice and the meaning often falling between the lines. You know, what is the writer not saying? What is the narrator not saying? You know,
what is he saying by not saying? Yeah.
Yeah. What is he hiding? You know, when he says something, does he really mean it straight up, or is it some sort of embroidered version of it? I mean, these are all things I learned as a songwriter, I feel. And in some ways, you know, these long first-person narratives that I produce, they're like kind of big songs, you know. And by the same virtue, I think I've always prioritized emotion in fiction. You know, I want to be moved by a novel. You know, I don't want just ideas. I want emotions. I want to be moved, you know. And that's because I came into it as a songwriter. You know, songs have to be moving.
Thank you very much for joining us, Kazuo.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
British novelist Kazuo Ishiguro speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the winner of the Tulsa Library Trust's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award for 2013. He's the author of The Remains of the Day, Never Let Me Go, and several other highly acclaimed novels. He'll be giving a free presentation to the public Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library. That is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.